who was Jeffrey Epstein? I mean, obviously we all know who he was. He was a predator responsible for the abuse of thousands of victims, all while being a top-level New York financier who handled billions of dollars for his clients. But like, is that it? Well, if you mainly get your information from mainstream American news sources, then yeah, you could easily be forgiven for thinking that's all there is to his story. After all, that's basically been the entire focus of the reporting on Jeffrey Epstein. But once you step even slightly outside of the US media bubble, you begin to realize that that's not necessarily an entirely accurate retelling of events. Because there was a whole second side to this guy's life, miles away from Wall Street. One where he was brokering surveillance contracts, assisting high-profile defense politicians across the planet, and even potentially acting as foreign intelligence. The idea that Jeffrey Epstein was an agent of foreign intelligence was considered at one point to be a relatively fringe conspiracy theory, but with the recent release of documents relating to his case, as well as a number of high-profile hacking campaigns by activist groups, this theory has kind of been revived, and you can even see it being discussed on many major news networks, mainly outside of the US. And so I wanted to gather the best of what we know in one place, break down some of these new bombshell revelations for you, and earnestly try to answer the question, was Epstein a spy? So I think it's worth running through the Epstein timeline, because it can be so easy to get lost around what happened when and who exactly was involved. And having a consistent timeline will make this story so much easier to understand. And I think the best place to start is in 2005. One day, a 14-year-old student comes home and tells her parents that a man had paid her $300 for a massage that had ended with this girl being abused. Her parents immediately rush to the police in West Palm Beach, Florida, and file a complaint alleging that this man, Jeffrey Epstein, had molested their daughter. The daughter explains that she'd been recruited by a friend of hers, and all of a sudden, this case blows up. The detective in charge ends up finding dozens of underage victims. The FBI steps in to take over from local police, and subsequently launches Operation Leap Year, designed to investigate the federal sex trafficking and transport of minors across state lines. The feds end up compiling a 56-page draft indictment detailing 32 counts against Jeffrey Epstein and his employees for a conspiracy to procure females under the age of 18. In this draft, they even mentioned that they found 11 victims from a single school in Florida. The FBI and DOJ had everything they needed at this point to begin dismantling this national sex trafficking network. And yet, they didn't. This is where stuff starts to get a little bit weird, okay? Not long after this draft indictment is written, the top prosecutor in charge of the case, a man by the name of Alex Acosta, decides to not sign off on it and pursue all of those charges. Instead, he offers Epstein something a little bit different. If he pleads guilty, then instead of being indicted for the 32 counts, he'll only face 2 state charges. And for those crimes, he'll spend just 18 months in jail, which was later reduced to 13 months. All of his co-conspirators would be granted immunity for life from any further federal investigation, and the federal probe against his network would, in effect, come to a dead stop. Epstein would also be allowed to leave prison for 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, to continue his work from his private home office. Pretty nice deal, all things considered. And so obviously, he agrees. At this point in the story, you might think that the feds would keep a pretty close eye on this dude, maybe take his passport away, or at least ask that he stay in West Palm Beach while the case concludes. But no, a couple of months before he's due to officially put in his guilty plea, Jeffrey instead decides to fly to Israel to take a tour of a newly constructed Israeli military base, according to Jeffrey Epstein's own PR representative. This is something that none of the major outlets that reported on the conviction even mention, and I had to piece this together from a clip of local TV in West Palm Beach and a snippet from a Page Six article on the matter. But it definitely happened. Okay, so already things are getting pretty sus, if I'm honest, but we're yet to have anything close to a smoking gun. And if that was all the evidence we had, then I would say that it's pretty reasonable to doubt the idea that Epstein belonged to any kind of foreign intelligence. Unfortunately, there is a lot more to this story. And I think what's far more noteworthy from this period is not whatever Epstein was up to in Israel, but instead what was happening in the US back in West Palm Beach, Florida. So the obvious question at this point is like, well, why did Epstein get such a cushy deal? Especially when the feds had so much info on his network and when Florida is already known for having some of the harshest criminal penalties in the entire United States. Well, remember the guy that gave Epstein that deal in the first place? If we fast forward about a decade from the Epstein case, Alex Acosta had moved up a lot in the world and was in the process of being confirmed as Donald Trump's Secretary of Labor, a role that would have him overseeing legislation that affects well over 100 million workers across the US. As part of this process, candidates usually have to go through some pretty thorough interviews, and allegedly, when asked about Epstein's famous sweetheart deal, Acosta explained his decision to let Epstein off so easily by saying, I was told Epstein belonged to intelligence and to leave it alone. This is according to the reporting of Vicky Ward, a journalist at the Daily Beast who cited an anonymous senior White House official. Around the time of Acosta's confirmation as Labour Secretary, Epstein was still a free man, and this could very well have been the end of the Epstein story. Clearly, the government wasn't interested in pursuing him any further, but journalists were thankfully working overtime to expose his crimes. After the Miami Herald published a viral series of high-profile exposés on Epstein in 2018, prosecutors in New York were forced to reopen investigations into him, which led to his eventual arrest and subsequent death in custody. That arrest revived scrutiny not just on Epstein, but also on Alex Acosta, the man who'd given him that deal in the first place. And ultimately, Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska sent a letter to the Justice Department formally asking that they review why Acosta had given Epstein such a nice deal back in 2008. Now, at this point, you might be able to anticipate what happens when you ask the US government to investigate itself. You'll be shocked, I tell you, to find out that in their report, they ruled that nothing untoward had happened and that Epstein was only given his sweetheart deal because of, and I quote, poor judgment on the part of the lead prosecutor, Alex Acosta. Nothing to see here. Well, except one thing. Let me show you, okay? Okay, so what you're looking at here is the Department of Justice's report into Alex Acosta. If we go all the way to page 313 out of 348, let me bring your attention to this line down here. After reviewing the emails, OPR identified a data gap in Acosta's email records. His inbox contained no emails from May 2007 through to November 2008. This is, like, pretty huge. Effectively, they're saying that for the exact time period where Jeffrey Epstein negotiated the sweetheart deal, they couldn't find a single inbound email between the lead prosecutor in charge of the case and Jeffrey Epstein's legal team or anyone else. This is the only time period that had missing emails. If you continue reading it, they actually blame it on some kind of server migration problem, and I'll let you decide whether or not you believe that. You know, maybe the servers really were down. Maybe my dog really ate my homework. Who knows? But what it does speak to is the fact that the official narrative seems to crumble as soon as it faces, like, the slightest bit of scrutiny. And something as important as a year of missing emails was seen as being so unimportant to the Department of Justice that they stuffed this note into the very end of a 300 plus page report. However, nothing of what I've presented so far still is, you know, cut and dry evidence. And for a long time, that was the reason why even I didn't necessarily entirely buy this idea that Epstein was working for a foreign government. There was a lot of suspicious evidence, but also stuff that was just a bit too circumstantial to be properly convincing. The Alex Acosta quote about Epstein belonging to intelligence came from a single anonymous source. Epstein's association with Ghislaine Maxwell was also pretty suspicious, given that her dad was so loved by the Israeli intelligence corps that six of Israel's spy chiefs attended his funeral. And obviously Epstein's flight patterns in and around his first case were also pretty suspicious. But honestly, the US judicial system has a long history of letting people off lightly, because they're well connected, and they don't necessarily have to be spies. Things have changed a lot in the last year, however, and we've now received a whole load of new information on the matter, and it's fair to say that we suddenly have a lot more insight on who Jeffrey Epstein really was. If you're in the US, it might feel like the release of the Epstein files hasn't really changed anything. After all, despite Pam Bondi claiming that they've released everything that they've got on the guy, there's somehow not a single person in the US who's faced new criminal charges. This is not so true outside of the US. Norway, for example, opened a corruption probe into their former prime minister. French police have raided the offices of one of their ministers over his links. And Prince Andrew in the UK was literally arrested by the police, marking the first time in almost 400 years that a British royal has been arrested. The last guy who got arrested was executed, so, you know. Despite what it might feel like at times, there is a lot of real material information in these files, and they've radically changed what we know about the relationship between Epstein and foreign intelligence. Specifically, they elucidate in great detail the relationship between Jeffrey Epstein and one man, a politician by the name of Ehud Barak. Okay, so calling Ehud Barak a politician is kind of an understatement. Let me just, like, read a small sample of this dude's CV so you can get an idea of what he was like. He is the most highly decorated soldier in Israeli history, having served in the IDF for over 35 years. He served as the head of Amman, Israel's military intelligence directorate. He headed up the entire IDF, and he was also prime minister and also defense minister for Israel. If there's one person on the planet who is connected to Israeli intelligence, it would be this guy. I don't even think he himself would disagree with that assessment. And it's really worth clarifying why this guy's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein is so much more important than anyone else's. After all, Epstein was obviously friends with lots of politicians, and nobody's pointing to the raids in the UK, Norway, or in France as evidence that Epstein was spying for any of those countries. And it really comes down to the specific nature of the relationship between these two men, and how different it was to Epstein's relationships with other senior political figures. Let me show you what I mean. So from what we know, these two guys first met around 2003, before Epstein's first conviction, but they maintained contact long afterwards. Barack was such a regular feature at Epstein's New York apartment that Epstein's own staff would sometimes refer to the unit as Ehud's apartment, according to an Israeli newspaper, which is already pretty bizarre. But it gets even crazier. What you're looking at right here is an email between Ehud Barak's wife and a redacted member of staff who worked for Jeffrey Epstein. And they're openly discussing how the Israeli government is going to take over Jeffrey Epstein's apartment to install surveillance equipment. They talk about sticking sensors to the window and adding the ability to remotely access the apartment. And this unnamed staff member says that Jeffrey does not mind holes in the walls, and this is all just fine. In another separate email between Ehud Barak and Jeffrey Epstein, they discuss an upcoming meeting with some Qatari investors in London. And Jeffrey Epstein even explicitly says that you should make it clear that I don't work for Mossad, Israel spy agency. These two guys were, without a doubt, extremely close business partners and really good personal friends. And when you begin to look just a little further into the deals that they actually successfully completed together, I think it becomes genuinely illogical to claim that Epstein wasn't dedicating a significant amount of his time to working for the benefit of the Israeli state. Let's talk about what these two guys got up to over in West Africa, specifically in the Ivory Coast. In 2010, the Ivory Coast went through a brutal political crisis. They had a really widely disputed election, and it triggered a new civil war. The guy who ended up coming out on top, President Ouattara, took over a country that was seriously fractured along various political and ethnic lines. And this is where Barak and Epstein saw dollar signs. In June 2012, while Ehud Barak was still serving as Israel's defense minister, the Ivorian president met him for dinner in Jerusalem for a meeting about science and technology cooperation. Meanwhile, on this exact same day, halfway across the world, that president's son was having dinner with none other than Jeffrey Epstein. Over the next few months, Jeffrey and Barak would repeatedly meet with Ivorian staff and Ivorian politicians, and Jeffrey Epstein was even good friends with this president's son and niece. Just 9 months later, Ehud Barak decided to step down from his role as defense minister ahead of some upcoming elections. At this point, officially, he was no longer affiliated with the Israeli government. But in reality, him and Epstein were both working extremely hard to negotiate defense contracts for the Israeli government. You can see this for yourself in their emails. Just a few months after Ehud Barak had resigned, he received a detailed proposal from a former head of Israeli intelligence. This guy wanted Israel to sell a signals intelligence package, or a SIGIN package, to the Ivory Coast. A SIGIN package is a full system of spying, basically. It's a system that can intercept landlines, cellular networks, satellite phones, tactical radio, and even specific targets like internet cafes. And throughout all of this, Epstein was the one coordinating the meetings and brokering the deals between the Ivory Coast and Israel. You can literally see this in the emails, that Epstein was clearly the fixer and was forwarding personal email addresses to Israeli officials, telling them that they should try and coordinate and be as flexible as they can to get this deal through. And surprise, just 2 months after the UN finally lifted an arms embargo on the Ivory Coast, Israel's foreign minister visited the country with more than 50 businessmen to sign an official defense and security agreement, one that was literally brokered by Jeffrey Epstein, so that this country could better spy on its citizens. And listen, maybe I'm off the mark here, but I don't think it's a stretch to say that if Epstein was willing to broker surveillance deals for Israel in the Ivory Coast, then he was probably willing to help advance Israeli interests in other countries. In fact, we don't even have to speculate on the matter, because Dropsite News, the outlet that first reported on this story, also revealed that Ehud Barak and Epstein did exactly the same thing in Mongolia. They, behind the scenes, brokered another security agreement in collaboration with the Israeli government. And over in Nigeria, Epstein and Barak oversaw the installation of a new facial recognition system, one that was developed by testing it on Palestinians crossing between Gaza and Israel. And we literally have audio recordings of Epstein trying to promote Palantir to Ehud Barak as some sort of potential business opportunity, and singing the praises of Peter Thiel.
However, he has a company called Palantir, P-A-L-L-E-N-T-I-E-R. So he thought that Peter would put you on the board of Palantir, so I wanted to talk to him.
And you might ask yourself, what happens to these countries after a dose of Epstein-brokered Israeli security? Well, I'm not super clued in on Mongolian politics, but I can speak to the Ivory Coast at least. Over there, President Ouattara has now been in power for over a decade, after he changed the constitution to remove term limits. Opposition candidates have been arrested and barred from running in elections, and even just last year, hundreds of protesters were arrested for protesting the country's authoritarian backsliding. This is what Epstein's deal-making produced when he worked with Ehud Barak and the Israeli government. It was pretty different to the stuff he was doing with, say, Prince Andrew. Epstein and Barak literally openly bragged in their emails about the scale of business opportunities that was being created by the explosion of civil unrest around the world, and how they could transform that civil unrest into cash flow. It's honestly like harrowing to read these emails, and I think it's quite naive to assume that they restricted themselves to like low and middle income countries in Africa and Asia, and didn't do the same thing in Europe or the Americas too. These international deals are, to me, by far the most convincing evidence that Jeffrey Epstein was a major asset to the Israeli government. I mean, if you're brokering multiple international arms and surveillance deals for another country, then like, yeah, you're a foreign asset at that point. But it's worth making clear that that is different to him being a spy in the traditional sense of the word. I don't think that Jeffrey Epstein was a spy, largely because he didn't need to be. A spy or an agent still operates within a bureaucracy. They have people they're accountable to and direct reports and direct underlings. For Epstein, it feels like it was a little different. He was clearly an asset to foreign governments, but he held a level of power and influence that let him completely bypass the traditional bureaucracy. And he had a direct line to the people who gave orders to the spies. I think it's fair to say that the spies worked for him, not the other way around.